Good afternoon. Well, I was thinking in preparing for these remarks closing the day that I should remember as an historian that when SMU was founded in 1911, there were three schools that were part of the university. There was the medical school, which has already been called to our attention as no longer part of the institution. There was the undergraduate college, and then there was
was it commerce?
No. Oops. Theology. Very good. All right, that's the last political comment I'll make for the day. I do want to say, however, that one of the questions which, although not explicitly raised in the panels and in the presentations today, was nevertheless echoed in a couple of the addresses, certainly, and in the background of the remarks of many people. It's a question that I've heard raised in all sorts of settings and venues here at the university. The question, simply put, is, what does the M in SMU stand for? Now, of course, as a Methodist and as part of the denomination religious tradition that was responsible for founding this university and a whole lot of other academic institutions to which our lunchtime speaker made reference, the reality is that Methodists created higher education institutions, including this one, not because they wanted to make more Methodists, but because it was part of the Methodist mission to make the society better, and that's why Methodists established orphanages and hospitals and institutions for the betterment of women, urban social centers, and colleges, universities, and schools, because it was part of the Methodist mission to enhance the larger society. Well, throughout the discussions today, the panels, the lectures, I've been listening for ways that perhaps some new implications for the M in SMU might have made themselves apparent. And I want to suggest that what I heard today were three ways that the M manifested itself. The first is that throughout our history as an institution and in our relationship between Dallas and the university, there have been what I'll call missed opportunities. That's the first M. The missed opportunities that I have heard referenced today included the ones that came up in the extraordinary panel that was moderated by Dean Jeffrey Orsak, where I discovered for the first time that there was a missed opportunity in the 1990s in a previous presidential administration for the university to have a circulating connection to the DART rail system, and that didn't happen because the university chose not to make an investment in that. Clearly, that was a missed opportunity. As I have had the privilege of traveling around to other places in the world, one of the things that has struck me as an extraordinary thing is the way that urban mass transit is an essential part of life. When my wife and I had our first home in New York City, for example, it never occurred to us to own a car. It's a useless thing to have as a resident of New York City because the urban transportation system is really what is the engine that drives the economy of the city. But not only there, I've lived in other places where urban mass transit was essential to the life of the city. I refer specifically to Washington, D.C., and its system, to the Atlanta system that I had the benefit of riding, and then two places that I'll mention abroad, Hong Kong, which has the most amazing subway system, where there are lights on every car indicating what the next station is, and in case you're disoriented, and I certainly was, there's even an arrow from one light to the next telling you which way it's going, and all of the announcements are made at least in Cantonese and English. A very user-friendly urban transit system something that we still don't have here in Dallas, and that's a missed opportunity for us as a university and as a city. I think also of another kind of missed opportunity that I encountered on a trip this summer to Singapore, where I had the not only the privilege, but really at the suggestion of one of the folks in central administration here at our university to visit an institution in Singapore called, are you ready? SMU, Singapore Management University. Part of the reason for going there was just to see if they'd borrowed our logo. But another part of the reason was that I had been able, through a connection I was able to make, to meet with the Dean of Students and, at his invitation, to attend orientation day for the entering class at Singapore Management University, a remarkable academic opportunity for me. But I also had a chance with some students to take a tour of this campus. Singapore Management University has built its buildings in a way that become a technological model for the rest of the city state of Singapore and really for other places in Asia. Everybody, every student carries a matriculation card. The matriculation card is something that one simply waves, or if you're a woman carrying a purse, you just wave your purse or pocketbook over an electronic sensor, and it knows whether your course schedule allows you access to that building or not. So it's a security system. A Virginia Tech couldn't happen at Singapore Management University because the only persons who have access to the building, faculty, staff, or students, are the people whose cards give them access. It would be a wonderful thing if a university in a city could use the most advanced levels of technology in constructing our buildings to say to the city, here's how you do it, when you do it as the state of the art. We aren't always able to do that, and I can tell you as a dean, the folks who are in charge of construction here would say, that's a great idea, but here's how much it's going to add to the cost of your building. And yet, I suspect it's a missed opportunity when we don't do state of the art everything. Well, let me switch from the M as a missed opportunity to a second reference to the M that I heard today, and that is marked transformations. I haven't heard it explicitly referenced by anyone else, so I'm going to be the one to name it. That Southern Methodist University, when it was founded in 1911 and opened for students for the first time in 1915, and for the first 37 years of its classes, was a segregated institution. And the first time African Americans were allowed to enroll as degree candidates at Southern Methodist University was in 1952. And that, from the perspective of 2011, may look like a tragedy compounded by the founders of the institution, who included church people and city people, which it was. But it's just as important to remember that what Southern Methodist University did in its desegregation in 1952 was precede the desegregation that occurred at other Southern universities, including my undergraduate institution, Duke, which was 10 years later than SMU in desegregation. And the pattern of desegregation happened first at this university. SMU led the way for the people of Dallas, who, from what we heard earlier about what happened with DISD, SMU was 20 years ahead of the city. There's something to be said for a university staking out its moral vision by saying, we're not going to wait until the city is ready for something to happen. We are going to help the city understand that it's time for something to happen. And that's a moral imperative. We at SMU can be proud of the fact that this university led the way in this part of the state on that matter, and that was a marked transformation. I want to shift to a different kind of marked transformation that I think was apparent as I was listening, and that is, this is an extraordinary institution for employment of persons, but not just the people who come with the highfalutin jobs as professor and president and provost, but also the people who have golden opportunities to come to work here as administrative assistant to the something or other, or library circulation officer, or whatever other kind of necessary administrative support position is offered here. And here's what that means: not simply a job or an employment opportunity. It means access to the whole system of benefits that SMU provides to every single employee, regardless of status, regardless of income. Just imagine what it means for a single parent with three children to get a job here as an administrative assistant in one low-level apartment, knowing that if her three children can be admitted to this university, there's an enormous dollar value as well as intellectual value available to her through the education that her children will receive here, simply as a fringe benefit of what the university will provide. That's an amazing contribution and something that the university can very seriously take pride in as a marked transformation in the lives of the people in that family. Another marked transformation is what our graduates do. And by graduates, I'm referring not only to those who walk out the door of Moody Coliseum with a BA or a BS, but also those who walk out the door with an MA, an MTS, a Master of Divinity, a PhD in some field. These are the people who go on and pursue their careers and do extraordinary things that we help them glimpse. And I'll only cite one example, happens to be a Perkins School of Theology graduate who is a pastor in West Dallas, who is serving an almost entirely Latino congregation, some members of which are themselves undocumented. And if you think of a typical Anglo church with the attendance registration pad passed through the pew, let me tell you, these people can't sign the registration pad. They can write, but they wouldn't put their names in a document out of fear. And yet that church provides a place for worship and gathering, and even more than that, by a story I heard that pastor tell in a gathering at Perkins School of Theology not too long ago. A young man who was participating in the church music program and who seemed every Sunday to show up and participate in the choir, but mostly sit there and fall asleep. And the pastor decided, with the choir sitting up front and the congregation out there, having one of the choir members fall asleep during the service was not necessarily a good marketing technique. So he decided it was his responsibility to talk to the young man and say, we can't have you up there. We just can't. So he made arrangements to have lunch with the young man, bought him lunch, and was ready at the end of the lunch to say, we can't have you up there. He decided to initiate the conversation by saying to the young man, why do you come? You don't seem all that interested. And he said, without looking at the pastor, because this is the only place I'm loved. So the pastor said, you just keep on coming. That's something that we, through our educational systems, help our graduates to capture a vision to be able to do. Not because we can give them the exact words to say, but we shape their minds and their visions for what's possible. Marked transformations. One more in this list, and then I'll get to the third M. Throughout the day, I heard reference in almost every discipline that was cited, I heard reference to the importance of critical thinking. And I just want to put a word in for all kinds of critical thinking. Not only the critical thinking that looks at existing technology and says we can do better, but the kind of critical thinking that reads philosophy, that reads great literature, that imagines ideas that don't have any obvious technological implications, but have the capacity to be a marked transformation of the mind. That's what we do here at this university. And we change people and we change the city through it. Third M that I heard today, I will call simply mysterious connections. One of the first encounters I had when I was here as the dean at Perkins School of Theology was a gathering downtown in Thanksgiving Square. There was a group of academics from Jordan, the country of Jordan, who were visiting here. And rather spontaneously, they decided they wanted to come to SMU for a visit. And somebody came over to me and whispered, "You're at SMU, aren't you?" "Yes." "Can you arrange to give these visiting Jordanians some time on the campus?" I said, "Well, I guess I could. I'll have to make a few phone calls." But I said, "I'm sure I could give them a tour of the campus." "Oh, no, they don't want a tour. They're already academics. They know what buildings look like. They want to meet students and faculty." I said, "It's July the 15th. What do you want me to do?" "Well, do what you can." Picked up the phone. I called the chaplain's office. Somebody answered. I said to her, "Can I speak to the chaplain?" "I'm sorry, he's not in the office." I said, "Oh, that's fine. Can I speak to the associate chaplain?" "I'm sorry, she's not in the office either." I said, "Okay, here's my problem. I've got a group of Jordanian academics who want to come to SMU and meet some faculty and students." And she said, "Oh, I'm the president of the Muslim Students Association. I'd be glad to meet with them, and we'll arrange to have them talk with a couple of faculty members." That could not possibly have been a planned event. We have to be open to the possibility of mysterious connections. Some of those mysterious connections occur in the form of what sociologist Robert Putnam called building social capital. And I heard a reference in this student panel earlier today to the essential element of sustainable partnerships that have to be created. That is the kind of capitalism that transcends financial capitalism and builds social capital. That's a mysterious connection. Perhaps one other I'll cite is not an SMU story, but it's something I heard in an interview really that was done about 16 years ago with the late Steve Jobs. It's important to remember about his education that he really didn't study anything having to do with technology. He studied art and poetry. But he knew that that was the way into a technological revolution, except that technology was going to serve the world in the context of the creation of beauty. It was the creation of beautiful things that made possible the mysterious connection that transformed the world. Stephen Jobs also didn't believe much in social science. He was asked in that interview, "When you're developing a new product, how many focus groups do you do when you're beta testing things?" He said, "None." And was asked why. He said, "Because in focus groups, you ask people, what do you want? But they don't know what they want until we show it to them. Then they look at it and say, oh yeah, that's what we want." What universities can do in partnerships with cities is create mysterious connections that offer marked transformations and that don't become missed opportunities to remake the world. That's what we do here, and that's what we can continue to do even better in partnership between the city of Dallas and this campus. Thank you very much.